supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we got a jam-packed show for you this week. We are going to tell you folks how to help your vegetable garden and your landscape through the hot, dry summers that are getting more and more common all across the country. We're also going to talk to Rachel Detto, an environmental educator at the Tyler Arboretum in Media, Pennsylvania, about how to tap maple trees for their sugary syrup. That's a lot to get done, so we better hop right to your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Russ, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hey, Mike, how are you today?
I am doing excellent today, Russ. How are you, sir?
Doing about the same. Enjoying the day.
And what day are you enjoying, or where are you enjoying it?
Well, we're enjoying it from Creston, North Carolina.
What can we do for Russ in Creston, North Carolina?
Well, I'll tell you, we have bought a Celeste fig tree from down in Raleigh, and it's at a lower and warmer area than we're in right now.
Right.
We were told by the people we bought it from that it would do fine up in the mountains, and we have heard horror stories from the folks that live up here that fig trees won't last.
Okay, so you're in the mountainous part of North Carolina.
Yeah, we're at about 3,800 feet up.
Oh, okay. So how cold do your winter nights get?
Well, we've had a few nights of like in the 19s and 20s.
Okay. Do you ever see single numbers?
Occasionally we will.
Okay.
But right now we actually have it in our cold storage cellar, so it's kind of out of the weather. It's just small, about 3 feet tall, and it's in a bucket right now.
Okay, when did you get it?
We actually got it in July.
I would have urged you to plant it in the fall.
Okay.
But here's what you do. Your fig situation is going to be exactly the same as someone in Pennsylvania. Matter of fact, I would suggest, are you like, do you know your growing zone, your little microclimate? Are you a six?
Yeah, sure do.
And is it six?
Yes, it is.
Yeah. Figs are Mediterranean. They are not reliably winter hardy. But here's the good news. No matter what happens to your fig, the roots will survive.
Okay.
So even if you do nothing and plant it in a stupid spot, the entire top part of the tree will die. But the crowns, the underground system, is very hardy. Want to plant it in a sheltered area, like near the walls of a house. Not necessarily facing south, because you don't want it to heat up in the winter and then chill back down. And ideally what you would do, you'll plant it in the spring, for instance, now. After you plant it, you're going to wait for it to start growing again. And then you're going to give it a little trim to stimulate growth. You may get figs this year, you may not. At the end of winter, do not prune it, but do something to protect it from the cold. The easiest thing to do is to pound some stakes in the ground around it and then wrap burlap around the stakes.
All right.
In a colder environment, you might have to build like a little outhouse for it or something like that.
Right, okay.
But I don't
that
think...
That was going to be my next question. Would it be okay in like wintertime if we did cover it completely with something to kind of keep the wind and things off of it?
As long as it breathes. Don't cover it with a tarp or plastic. Some older Italians will build like a box, a little house frame.
Right.
And then they'll throw burlap over that and then rope that around. That's pretty much the ideal. Alternately, you can actually soak the soil, rock the tree out of the ground, push the tree down to the ground, and cover it with like old carpeting and soil and leave it there like underneath the soil line all winter, and then bring it up and right it again in the spring. That's an old Italian trick of trenching your fig in a cold climate. The important thing for you is on your property, don't plant it in a low spot where frost collects. You want to plant it at the highest elevation that your high elevation has. Make sure it's not in a frost pocket, and sheltered by the sides of a house or the sides of a shed, something like that, from the wind. And then with your winter weather, I think you'll get by with minimal protection, although I think it should be wrapped with some burlap around a structure. And then in the spring, when you unwrap it and it starts to grow again, just prune off any winter-damaged areas. And by keeping the most biomass intact over winter, you'll get a long enough growing season to be able to harvest nice figs. I think you're going to do just fine.
Thank you so very much for your time. I appreciate it.
My pleasure, Russ. Have fun.
You have a great day. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
All right, bye-bye.
1-888-346-9499. Carol, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hello.
Hello, Carol. How are you?
Fine, thank you.
And where is Carol Fine?
In Ridley Park, Pennsylvania.
Okay, out by the airport.
Yes.
Okay. What can we do for Carol in Ridley Park?
Okay. I have two camellia plants. I've had them for about 7 years.
Really? Outside?
Yes, they're very nice, and they get a lot of buds until the Mr. Squirrel comes and takes half of them, and then I get the rest in beautiful blooms. But unfortunately, of the two plants, they're about 7 foot apart. One is red and is now about 5 foot tall and about 5 foot wide.
Mm-hmm.
The other one is like a dark pink, but it is only grown to be about 3 foot high and only about 3 foot wide. And unfortunately, this winter when I looked at it, the edge of every leaf is dead all the way around the entire leaf, about a half inch in. It still has its buds because they bloom quite early in the season, you know, after the new year. But the buds are not falling off. The leaves are not falling off. I just don't know why that plant has the dead edges all the way around about a half inch in.
I would suggest to you that this plant either gets much more sun than the other plant or is less protected from brutal winds than the other plant.
All right. They're both very well protected. They're about 3 feet in from a nice high wooden fence, and they're in a sheltered backyard, which has a pergola nearby, which blocks a lot of wind. So that would it be too much water at one place and not another?
If water pools up, that's bad for 99% of plants.
A neighbor's rain spout seems to be directed right above that, so it could get more water.
At the struggling one?
Yes.
Oh, well, that's easy to do. Very easy to go over to the neighbor. No?
No.
Because, I mean, you can just buy a gutter extension and put it on so that, you know, they make them as, like, floppy things.
Yes, I'm aware of that accordion kind, yes.
Yeah, and then it can just flop out when it's filled with water, and it'll take the water past where it's draining onto your plant. They would be against that?
Yeah.
They're not friendly neighbors.
Right.
Okay.
But would that be the reason that they're...
Oh, yeah, sure. Yes. The symptoms you describe are actually very typical of sunburn.
Oh.
On a camellia. But yes, although they do like a fair amount of water, they need good drainage. Matter of fact, one of the things that hurts camellias the most is planting them too deeply. Mm-hmm. They like to be planted very high. Mm-hmm. They like to be able to get a lot of air around their roots. That's a corollary of good drainage. One of the things good drainage does, it allows air around the roots, which is actually very beneficial for plants. Otherwise, they smother like plants. You know, we've heard so much about Hurricane Sandy. So many plants were killed because they were submerged.
Right.
And it's not that they were submerged in salt water. They were just plain submerged. And
Right. Very
few plants can tolerate that.
Yeah, I don't see puddling there, but I'm sure it just gets too much water there.
But they are planted on your property.
Correct.
And the gutter drains on another property.
Yeah, they have a driveway right there, and the way they made their driveway, it slants the water onto mine. It has already killed my apple tree. But
it's easy peasy. No, all you need to do is install some edging to channel the water down the driveway,
or
dig a little ditch on your side of the driveway that'll funnel the water away from your plants and ideally down to some sort of drain or the street or something.
Very good.
But you're not helpless. There's many things you can build on your side. And yes, that should improve matters. Now, they have acidic soil, right?
Yes, because they do. produce a lot of buds until Mr. Squirrel comes and takes a bite out of each one and throws them away, and they get wasted.
Yeah, we hear this a lot with rhododendrons as well. And two things you can do. One is buy what's called a motion-activated sprinkler that you hook up to your hose and point it at the camellias during the season. And then anytime a squirrel comes near the camellias, it'll get hit with automatic cold water from the sprinkler.
Okay.
Or spray the buds when they're still tightly closed heavily with deer repellent to give them a nasty smell.
Oh, that's a good idea.
There's also hot pepper repellents you can buy. Evil squirrels, they don't like a bad taste in their mouth any more than anybody else does. The secret is to spray the buds while they're still tight so you don't damage the flowers.
Okay. Thank you very much.
All right. My pleasure. You take care.
Thank you. Enjoy your show. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and remind listeners that Valentine's Day is coming up. And while roses are the traditional posy to be preferred, it's red tulips that actually mean I love you in the ancient floral code known as the language of flowers. Buy your tulips potted, feed, water, and expose the green leaves to bright light after those flowers fade. Rest them over the summer, plant them outdoors in the fall, and they may become a symbol of eternal love blooming year after year. But don't go tracking down those tulips just yet, because we'll be right back with more of your fabulous phone calls, how they tap maple trees for that tasty syrup, and how to keep your plants alive during a hot, dry growing season. I'm Hot and Dry Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Garden.
Burpee supports You Bet Your Garden and offers over 80 new varieties for the 2013 growing season, including Super Sauce, a 2-pound sauce tomato, and On Deck, a sweet corn you can grow in a container. These and more can be seen online at burpee.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up, hot and dry weather gardening. As global warming gets worse, our gardens get hotter and drier. How can we still raise a season's worth of food? We'll tell you some tricks you can do to take the heat off of your tomatoes and other living things. We'll also go back to more of your fascinating phone calls. But now it's time to welcome our guest, Rachel Detto from Tyler Arboretum here in the Philadelphia area. Every year, Tyler has a maple syrup sugaring festival and pancake breakfast. And I know everybody out there is fascinating with the topic of tapping maple trees. So Rachel has come in to edumacate us about the sap that flows and is sweet. Rachel, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you very much.
Well, let's just get started right away. I've always been curious as to who figured this out? Was the tapping of certain trees for their sweet sap a trick that Native Americans did, or did it come over with immigrants?
Actually, it was Native Americans. It was something that the Native Americans in the Northeast were credited with developing. The colonists that came over knew nothing about it before they were taught by the Native Americans.
And were they quick adopters of it? Because sugar was hard to get in that era, right?
Oh, yes, it was. Before then, they also had cane sugar as well. But they discovered that, or they adapted the Native Americans' usage for the maple sugar. And over time, the cane sugar sort of won out because of the scarcity and the difficulty of making maple syrup.
Now, do we have any idea? I know today maple syrup is tapped by knocking a metal tap into the tree and having tubing that leads to buckets. Do we know what the Native Americans did? Was it close to that?
It's actually very close. The technology has not changed all that much. The technique has not. The Native Americans, what they would do initially is cut a giant slash into the maple trees and then stick a little piece of bark or something at the very bottom of it and let that drip into a bucket, usually made out of bark. When the colonials came over, they used an auger, which would drill a hole into it and then stick a little spile into it. And that was just a hollow tube, and that dripped into a bucket. Now we do the same thing. Some people drip into buckets, some people drip into tubing.
Now, we use the sugar maple, which is a native tree, but don't all maples produce some type of sap, and don't people tap other maples?
Yes, yeah, some people can tap other maples. The distinction with the sugar maple is that it has the most concentrated sap, has the most bang for your buck. You can get, I think the sugar sap level is about 3%, between 2 and 5% sugar. The rest is just water. In other maple trees, it can be as low as 0.02%.
Is there any difference in the taste if we were to tap a different type of maple? Would it be less tasty? Would it be bitter? Or is maple sugar maple sugar?
In some cases, there have been reports that the flavor is a little bit different. It might be a little smokier. There might be different chemicals in there that you don't really want to mix in. So sugar maples are definitely the tastiest, but they're mostly used because they're the easiest to tap.
And they're some of the biggest maples.
Yes, they are.
Interestingly, in horticulturally, in landscape use, they're considered pretty nasty. They're not trees you want to plant on your property to plant a tree.
I didn't know that. I thought they were beautiful trees.
Well, they're kind of beautiful, but they grow fast. They're kind of big. They get kind of spindly in their old age, as will I.
Yeah, well, they do grow fast, which is probably a benefit for them. You can't tap a tree that's too young or too small. It has to be old enough. So,
what is the age of consent in tapping?
The age of consent for a tapping tree, as much consent as we can get from a tree, would have to be about 30 to 40 years old. And mostly it's depending on how big the tree is. A tree has to be a minimum of 10 inches in diameter, which is about 31, 32 inches in circumference to put one tap in it. After that, as the tree gets older and gets bigger, you can add more taps. You never, ever, ever want to put more than three taps in. That just takes too much from the tree.
And exactly. I mean, because I know some people out there are probably concerned, doesn't this harm the tree? How can a tree have so much? I mean, this is the blood of the tree, the sap.
Exactly.
How can it have this much to spare, so to speak? Aren't we being vicious Americans and seizing it?
A tree can produce thousands of gallons of sap during the course of its lifetime. And actually, I use the analogy of giving blood. When you're a human, a fully adult human being giving blood, you're giving about 10% of your blood. When we take sap from a tree, we're taking maximum about 3 gallons a day. And that, over the course of the season, it's probably about 10%.
So it doesn't harm the tree when it's done properly. Is there any benefit to tapping a tree? Do they get bloated with sap if you just don't, you know?
No, they won't get bloated with sap. They're pretty well adapted to, you know, keeping their own sap in their own system. But like I said, the amount of sap that is tapped is never, ever enough to actually harm the tree.
And maples are notorious for being, quote, bleeders, right? The pruning rules for maples are very complex. Because they do have a lot of sap and they do push it out very freely.
Yeah, they will push the sap out. The time period that you're tapping the tree to is very, very important. And that has to do with the freezing and the thawing and the pressure that's actually built up inside the tree. If you don't let the tree bleed out, you know, it's not going to hurt the tree, but that pressure built up inside is what allows us to tap the tree to begin with.
And if I remember correctly, I've not done this myself, I have friends who do it, the tapping takes place a lot earlier than most people think it would, right?
Yes, it does. Usually the tapping season, depending on where you are.
Let's say Pennsylvania.
Pennsylvania has a little bit earlier season than most other places in the Northeast because we're a little further south. Our tapping season's probably mid to late January into mid-February or so.
So by the time most people think of it who are first-timers, they've missed the boat.
Right. You have to do it when you've got the freeze and the thaw, when you've got very, very cold nights below freezing at night and very, very warm days where the ice starts to melt.
So last winter was the warmest winter in history. Did that turn out to be a very sucky year?
That was a terrible year for maple sugaring. It was a terrible year for sap production. They ended up having they initially put in more taps over the course of the season. They put more taps in generally all over the place in the Northeast, and they ended up producing less syrup than the previous year.
Now, this year we've had a couple of very cold spells over winter. It's certainly 1 week of extended colder weather than we're used to while still experiencing our climate is warming, whether no matter what the cause, the climate is warming. So do you think we had enough of a freeze so far?
Well, it's not the initial freeze. It's the freeze and then thaw. So as long as we get the cold nights, warm days, I think that the sustained cold period that we had may have kickstarted it. And now that it's warmer, the trees are starting to come out of dormancy. The problem is when it stays too warm consistently and then the trees start to bud out. And that's when you have to stop producing.
And that's when the sap gets bitter, right?
Yes, the sap starts to change. The tree's basically woken up out of its dormant state. It's bringing up amino acids, all sorts of things that affect the taste of the sap after that point.
Now, when we tap maple syrup, it comes out little lines into buckets. Mm-hmm. And then the stuff in the buckets is taken and boiled down, which is a pretty laborious, time-consuming process. Here's a stupid question. What keeps the bugs out of the buckets? You know, because there's always life flying around, and this is sugar, and everything loves sugar.
Yep. Well, nothing really keeps them out. Unless you've got a sieve over top of your bucket, nothing is really going to keep it out.
So there's a lot of protein, you're saying?
It could be, yeah. So what that's going to happen is all of that liquid, all the sap coming out, it's very, very watery. It's a little bit sugary. All that stuff is going to go into a big evaporator pan. You're going to boil it down as much and get as much of the water out as you can. And
but you're kind of dodging the question
here. Well, after that, that's when you have to sieve all the debris out.
But we no longer qualify as vegan, do we?
Well, yeah, maybe not.
A lot of springtails and gnats, I would imagine.
Gnats, flies, ants get into it. If you come to the arboretum, you'll see some of that on some of our trees.
How festive.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's all natural.
And this is an energy consumptive process as well, right? You need to be boiling and evaporating.
Yes. Yeah, it is. Many backyard boilers, many backyard maple sugar producers, they'll do it in the Northeast if they have a lot available where they can burn wood. So they'll thin out the lots during that time of year, and they'll use all the logs and everything else to fuel their maple sugaring process. The big ones are using a whole host of different techniques to try and get as much water out with the least amount of energy. Some use reverse osmosis. Some use pressurized steam to actually force the water out. There's a whole bunch of different ways.
And you start with a gallon of sap. And how much maple syrup do you get?
Not much at all.
Oh.
Not much. If you were going to make, let's do it the other way. If you were going to make a gallon of syrup, you would need about 40 gallons of sap. So you need a lot of sap. You're taking out most of the water. You're taking out a whole host of water.
But we presume the early versions that the Native Americans used were not that sweet then. They were very watery.
Well, sometimes they would use just the water, and they would call it sweet water. But most times what they would actually do is boil it further past maple syrup to get to maple sugar, because that was actually easier to store.
Right. That would never go bad.
Exactly. Maple syrup, you have to refrigerate, or it has to be pasteurized, all of that, you know, lots of precautions need to be made. With maple sugar, it's dry, it's fine. Just have to worry about a mouse getting to it, that's all.
That's right, which I can imagine when you're working mostly with wood would be really difficult.
Yeah, all sorts of critters.
All right, fascinating stuff. Rachel Detto is an environmental educator at the Tyler Arboretum here in the Philadelphia area. They will be hosting their annual maple syrup celebration and pancake breakfast on Saturday, February 23rd from 8 a.m. to 1 p.m. if you're in the Philadelphia area. If you're outside the Philadelphia area and you're in a cold weather climb, I'm sure a local arboretum near you is doing some of the same stuff. If you're in warm weather, forget it, right? Because
yeah,
you need cold winters.
You kind of need the cold, yeah.
All right. One more reason to be happy for winter, those of us in the Mid-Atlantic and Northeast states. Rachel Detto from Tyler Arboretum, thanks very much for coming into You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you so much for having me.
And now, back to your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Elliot, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. How are you?
I'm doing good, Al. How are you?
Good.
And where is Elliot Good?
I live in East Norriton.
And that's in Pennsylvania. That's a little area just outside of Philadelphia.
Yes.
All right. What can we do for Elliot in East Norriton?
Well, about a year and a half ago, I noticed that there was these rubbery dots on my automobile. The driveways where I live are separated by a flower bed. I imagine that it happened while I was driving on the Pennsylvania Turnpike, because it looked like little asphalt sprays. And I even asked my insurance company to investigate it, and they had no idea what it was. Subsequently, I have a new automobile, and I noticed one day while washing it that those dots were on my automobile.
Is it a light-colored car, Elliot?
It's red, but bright.
Right, so it shows the dark.
Yes.
I'm presuming these flower beds are mulched with wood mulch.
Oh, yes.
Okay. So you keep parking there, Elliot. You could wind up with a black car. You know, you can just let the process continue, you know. These things can shoot 30 feet in the air, so you'll even get tinted windows eventually.
Yes, I noticed that the garage door, the gutter, and various spots around the flower beds were
covered
with rubbery dots. Yeah, and they're very hard to get rid of also.
Have you actually had success getting rid of them? Because these are fungal spores. Once they stay attached to like siding or a car side, most people have described them as impossible to get off without ruining the surface.
Well, what you have to do is you have to use a polish, tar and bug remover, something like that. But I've been lucky. Ever since the winter started and the temperature went down, there hasn't been any of these spores.
Right, because they're not active over the winter. For those who aren't aware of what we're talking about, wood mulch, these bark mulches, these chipped up bark and wood mulches, were never a good idea horticulturally, but they've become ubiquitous since landfills stopped accepting wood waste. An entire industry has popped up to, quote, recycle this wood, but rather than do something harmless with it, like turn it into firewood pellets, they sell it to homeowners, they pile it on much too deep, and wood wants to break down, wants to become soil, and various fungal organisms in the environment help it to do so. Some of these harmlessly, but artillery fungus, as you've learned, accelerates the process of degradation by absorbing energy from the wood and using it to fuel kind of a shotgun-like elements that are the spores that carry the organism to another place. And they're very attracted to light-colored objects. And anyone who uses wood mulch over a period of years, is eventually going to be hit with these fungal bodies. Now, do you live in some sort of a housing complex where you have no control over what happens to the flower beds?
Yes, there's a development, and I spoke with the people on the landscape committee. At first, they thought I was crazy. Then they went on the internet and found out that it's really true.
If you want some more information on it, go to our website. Go to youbetyourgarden.org, and there's a section called Garden Answers A to Z. Go down to the letter W or M, and under wood and under mulch, not only are there articles describing the artillery fungus, but there's links to university bulletins. Penn State University and Ohio State University especially have been in the lead about this. But now that your landscapers for this community know about the problem, stay on them, and armed with the information that's in those articles and the university studies, you should be able to get them to change to compost, and it'll be miraculous. There won't be any artillery fungus. Everything will get better.
Great. Thank you so much. I really appreciate your knowledge.
Well, good luck, and I appreciate your phone call. We can't warn people about this enough. Thank you, sir.
All right. Thank you.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and warn listeners that my springtime tour continues. I'll appear at the Upper Dublin Public Library at 7 p.m. on President's Day. That's Monday, February 18th. The Suburban Home and Garden Show at the Expo Center in Oaks, PA, Friday through Sunday, February 22nd through the 24th. At the Wilmington Home Show at the Chase Center, Saturday and Sunday, March 2nd and 3rd. And at the Philadelphia Flower Show on Wednesday, March 6th. But don't go looking for all the details at the events section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back with more of your fabulous phone calls and how to dodge a bullet during a hot and dry summer. I'm Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Garden.
Burpee supports You Bet Your Garden and offers over 80 new varieties for the 2013 growing season, including Super Sauce, a 2-pound sauce tomato, and On Deck, a sweet corn you can grow in a container. These and more can be seen online at burpee.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we're in the stretch now, cats and kittens. In just a little bit, we'll be getting to a topic that gets more and more important every year as our summers get warmer and our winters get warmer and rain often gets scarcer. How to have a nice summer garden when the temperatures are too hot and the rain is too scarce. You won't want to miss it, and you won't. It's coming up right after a couple more of your fascinating phone calls. At 1-888-346-9499. Dory, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hello.
Hello, Dory. How are you?
I'm fine in Medford, New Jersey.
Okay, very good. She knows the drill. What can we do for Dory in New Jersey?
Mike, I like to walk in a woodland trail at Smithville Park. And I have a friend who occasionally will trip on the roots that cross the path. So my question for you is this. If I go to the park superintendent and I ask them to paint those roots yellow so we can see them and we won't trip on them, is there a way to do that without hurting the trees?
Well, it's funny that you ask this question today, because today, as we're doing the show, for some reason, there is a massive cable running right outside the door. And we have all these signs, warning, cable, don't trip on the cable. And the cable is brightly colored, and I have fallen 3 times. So I'm not sure that painting would be the answer. And I'm presuming you're walking down woodland trails where these are the grand old men of the forest. These are trees that are 50, 60, 70 feet tall.
They're pretty big.
So I don't think there's anything that you could spray on those roots that would be brightly colored that would harm the trees. The above ground parts of the roots appear mostly through erosion, you know, as rain washes soil away, and some trees, notoriously maples, have roots that are already very close to the surface, very aggressive surface roots. The roots being close and the soil washing away creates this situation. And a lot of times when we're walking through the woods, we're not looking down. So I think they probably have access to, I'm sure there's something called horticultural paint that they could spray on it that would make it a bright color. But to make it safer, what I would suggest they do is build little berms around the roots. Get a couple of wheelbarrows of soil, dump them over top, pat it around so that it's a natural hump as opposed to this giant python laying on its side. And the more you can level out the hump, the more you can make it a slow grade, the more it'll just be like a regular part of the path. It won't hurt the tree to cover these roots. These roots were once underground. The remarkable thing about these above ground roots is they don't care where they are. They can be above ground. They can be below ground. To tell you the God's honest truth, if there was a real rogue one that was really above ground and really thick and really in the way and the tree was healthy, you could chainsaw that root out and just remove it, and it wouldn't harm the tree, and then you could level out the land. But this sounds like a simple case of erosion where a couple wheelbarrows full of soil or compost, or in a situation like this, even wood chips could be used to create like a little natural ramp. I can see where you're going with the brightly colored paint, but I just fear that that's not going to help a lot of people, you know, because what fun is it to walk through the woods and be staring down all the time? It's not like the city where you're going to find $20 bills or a quarter blown around down there, right?
You're right.
You want to look up. You want to see butterflies. You want to see evil squirrels jumping from tree to tree. You want to see birds. You don't want to be staring at your shoes. I know the park of which you speak. They have great caretakers. And if these are trails, if these are marked trails, they should be kept safe. They don't want anyone falling out there. That's bad for them. That's bad for the park. That's bad for the person who cracks a hip.
Oh, okay. I like your answer, and thank you very much.
Oh, thank you, Dory. It's a great question. You take care.
Bye-bye.
1-888-346-9499. Bill, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you.
Well, thank you, Bill. How are you, sir?
Okay.
And where is Bill okay?
Chester Springs, Pennsylvania.
Okay. Not far from Philly, right?
Right.
All right. What can we do for Bill in Chester Springs?
I'm looking to put in a vegetable garden, like a 10 by 15 foot. And my girlfriend and I are disputing about I was just going to take a tiller and till up the grass and then pick through and get rid of that and just put a, you know, good topsoil or something in there and mix it up in there and make a garden. But she's saying that you got to use a pitchfork to get the grass out. It's supposed to be better than a tiller.
Oh, okay. Okay. So that's the bet, so to speak. Who's right? The one who wants to till it up or the one who wants to use a pitchfork?
Yeah.
You're both wrong. First of all, tilling up grass is a great way to plant a lawn. Most of the grasses we plant are running grasses with rhizome-like root systems that love to spread. And a lot of plants that work that way are thrown into a field, and then the field is tilled to multiply the plants. So tilling grass ensures that grass will be your predominant weed. And especially, it sounds like you're just planning to grow on a flat surface with very minimal preparation, which would mean that grass will overtake your garden by the 4th of July. Everything about that will work poorly. Plus, when you till, there are just millions of dormant weed seeds in an area as big as you describe. Tilling exposes them to the light, which is the trigger for germination. And then what do? After you're done tilling them, you cover them with soil. And then you're going to water that area and put plant food down. And you're going to be shocked when all these weeds come up. Well, you should be proud. You probably planted those weeds much better than you would have planted any kind of a vegetable garden. The first thing I'll tell you is flatland gardening is for suckers. What you want to do is build a couple of raised beds. You'll get more great vegetables out of a couple of 4x8 raised beds than you will a flat ground garden that's mostly growing fescue and bluegrass. So you have two choices. You can either cut that lawn really low, really scalp it, really drop that mower blade down. Do you see dirt coming out?
Right.
And then lay single sheet of cardboard over the entire surface you want to garden. On top of that, you want to create structures that are about a foot high and that are no wider than 4 feet, because you're not going to walk in these garden beds where you're going to be growing your crops. Soil compaction is the second biggest human cause of plant death. Overwatering will always be first. So 4x8 is the standard size. That fits standard lengths of lumber. You can also use pavers, Trex.
Yeah, Russ, I did frame it out with, I think it's 8x8x16 cinder block across the back.
Cinder blocks are absolutely fine, but never wider than 4 feet, because you're not going to step in the growing area.
Okay,
so 4 feet is the maximum width of the beds, but they can be as long as you want. They can be 15 feet long if you like, as long as you don't mind walking around them. Leave 2 feet in between each bed for your walking lanes. You're going to need that much room, especially if you're good at this and the plants get big. By the end of August, giant heirloom tomatoes are really encroaching on your lanes. Okay, so 4-foot-wide beds, 2-foot-wide lanes, and over top of the cardboard, fill them up with a mixture of screen black topsoil and yard waste compost. The genius of growing in these raised beds is the lawn can grow right up to the edge of them, but lawn grasses can't climb up the side of the cinder blocks or the raised beds. So the grass that always works its way sideways into a flat ground garden will not come into your garden. So you're going to start out with 95% fewer weeds than any other gardener, except for the other people who are doing raised beds correctly, have to worry about. So you put in your plants, you put a nice mulch of shredded leaves or more compost on top, and you have essentially a self-sustaining garden from that point on. If you have high-quality compost that you started with and you made a 50-50 mix, that's all the food your plants are going to need that season. You keep a nice mulch on the surface of the soil, no new weeds will blow in. You'll reduce your watering needs in the heat of the summer. It's like painting a room. Preparation up front pays off big time in the long run.
Okay.
All right, Bill?
Okay.
All right. Good luck, sir.
Okay. Thank you.
Take care.
Okay. You too. Bye.
All right. As promised, it's time for the question of the week. And it's time we tackled this very important topic, which we're calling Some Like It Hot, But Most Plants Do Not. Alexis Landis, first of all, welcome back to You Bet Your Garden after your maternity leave.
Thank you, Mike. I'm happy to be back.
We're happy to have you here. Would you read this week's questions, please?
Absolutely. We heard from Brianne in Oklahoma City, who writes, with rain being scarce and the city rationing water, I'm hoping you can help me select some drought-resistant veggie varieties. Last summer, it seemed like the soil moisture was just steaming away, so I would also appreciate any watering tips. And do I need to partially shade plants that would normally be considered full sun? We also heard from Jan in Oklahoma City, who writes, the climatologist reports for rain this coming season are not encouraging. What measures can a homeowner take to keep trees and perennials alive while being frugal with water resources? And finally, we heard from Sam in Oklahoma City. I'm sensing a trend here. The last two seasons, it seems we've had about 2 weeks of spring and then brutally hot summer weather until Thanksgiving. Are there vegetables that can survive our hot, long summers? Thanks, and I love your show.
Yeah, you'd think this was a place that Ken Burns had made a documentary about or something. Well, if global trends continue, more and more gardeners just about everywhere are going to face similar problems in seasons to come. So folks who have suffered through any unusually long, hot, dry spells will want to pay close attention regardless of where you live. This can happen to you. And many of the tricks and techniques we're about to describe will benefit you as well. Now, I looked up the average monthly temperatures for the Oklahoma City area, and Sam is correct. But spring is always going to be brief, where the average daytime high in March is in the 60s. And unfortunately, July and August days are always going to average in the mid-90s, meaning that the pollen of temperature-sensitive crops like tomatoes, peppers, and sweet corn should be expected to fry for those 60 days. So for at least some of the traditional crops of summer, hot climb growers might want to treat July and August like we northerners treat January and February. And you can. Your warm springs allow you to put plants in the ground a month or two ahead of my Pennsylvania garden. Put good-sized plants of short-season tomatoes outside on, say, April 1st, and you'll have 90 days of ideal growing time before the gates of hell open up. Same thing on the back end. Put out good-sized plants when it starts to cool down a little bit around September 1st, and you'll get another 90 days or close to it. And you can extend both those seasons into the hot middle with a trick that professionals use, shade cloth. It's always a good idea to locate a hot climate garden in a spot that gets afternoon shade. But if you can't do that, consider building a hoop house-like frame structure that you can run shade cloth over. This specialized fabric provides a surprising amount of solar reprieve. I would also advise everyone who gardens where water is scarce to invest heavily in rain barrels, or even a big cistern if you grow on a large scale. Oklahoma tends to get the most rain in May and June, so collecting gutter water then could easily spell the difference between your having a garden of Eden and you being a depressing shot in Ken Burns' Dust Bowl documentary. Elevate these structures as high as possible so the gravity will feed the water to your plants. You should also investigate gray water systems. Wherever legally possible, those in rain-scarce climates should attempt to reuse shower, tub, and even washing machine drain water. Harvested or gray, feed this extra water into drip irrigation lines. Covered with mulch to prevent evaporation, drip lines are the most efficient way to water. And there should always be an inch or two layer of that mulch on the soil surface to keep moisture in the ground. Now, early morning is always the best time to water, and you should always water at the base of the plants. In hot and dry climes, the air is going to eat up half the water from a sprinkler. And in hot and humid climes, hello, St. Louis, overhead watering makes disease woes much worse. And yes, there are preferred choices for hot weather gardens. The Henry Field seed catalog has a Southern Performer logo on some varieties, so I called and asked them what it meant. Product specialist Jenna Monin replied that it indicates varieties that are heat tolerant and resistant to pests and diseases that are more common down south. Asked to name the top performers for hot climates, she says, well, of course the old standbys for summer are okra and cowpeas. Any variety will do well. Most summer squash seem to do well in the heat, with early golden summer crookneck especially popular. Early contender bush bean, twilight eggplant, and most hot peppers. For sweet peppers, I've been told that Big Bertha and sweet banana do especially well in the heat. For tomatoes, celebrity and Arkansas traveler. And for small fruit, she highly recommends Black Magic Blackberry from the breeding program at the University of Arkansas. She says she personally saw it setting fruit in the middle of a 105-degree heat wave. She also recommends Caroline raspberries and O'Neill Southern Highbush blueberries. I'll add that a 1993 Organic Gardening magazine story found that all cherry tomatoes do well in extreme heat. For full-size fruits, hot weather growers are urged to try the, quote, heat-set tomatoes, like Solar Set, Heat Wave, and Surefire. All are bred to produce viable pollen in hot temperatures. Well, that sure was some useful information about gardening in the new world of global warming, wasn't it? Luckily for you, the question of the week appears in print at the Gardens Alive website, where you can read it with links to more detailed information on many of the topics we covered at your leisure. Just click the link at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. Yikes! My producer is threatening to shred my shade cloth if I don't get out of this studio. We must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 1-888-346-9499 or send us your email, your tired, your poor, your wretched refuse teeming towards our garden shore at garden@whyy.org. Please tell us where you live. Put the actual subject in the subject line and check voiced to see if the information you seek is already waiting for you at our website, youbetyourgarden.org, where you can click through to the question of the week. Find the solution to hundreds of garden problems, hint, hint, just like yours, hint, hint, in our Garden Answers A to Z section. Watch the video of my recent TEDx talk. Listen to this show, listen to old shows, download this week's podcast, and follow us on Facebook. Elizabeth Perez Luna is executive producer of audio content for WHYY. Ken Queter plays our theme song. Our engineer this week has been Al Banks. Rich Banowitz and Sarah Kazar are You Bet Your Garden's Internet Illuminati. Our social media director, Amanda McGrath. Ace production assistant, sap-sucking Brett Rader. Esteemed editor, Al Banks. And me, the unmanageable Mike McGrath. All welcome back from maternity leave, Alexis Landis, who proudly produces You Bet Your Garden for WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. We'll see you next week. Starting your own plants from seed is not for the timid. I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden, we'll discuss how to water without being weckless and why sunny windowsills can be horticultural horror shows. Plus your fabulous phone calls.